kind of went against the perspective that my party had taken on this.
The Future of the Violence Against Women Act. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, August 10th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the Fairbanks Diocese celebrates the half-century mark.
Our diocese is about the size of 1.5 Texases, 410,000 square miles.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
Alaska Governor Sean Parnell has appointed an Anchorage lawyer to the state Supreme Court to replace a justice recently named to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Parnell appointed Peter Mawson, who came to Alaska in 1980 with his wife and has been in private practice most of his career. He replaces Justice Morgan Christen. Mawson is a partner at a general civil law firm. The Alaska Supreme Court consists of a Chief Justice and four Associate Justices. The governor picked Mawson from a list of two applicants nominated by the Alaska Judicial Council. A reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act has slowed in Congress. The House and Senate have passed their own versions of the bill, and as APRN's Peter Granitz reports, if the two chambers want to reconcile the two bills, they'll need to address issues of native sovereignty and tribal courts.
Since it first passed nearly 20 years ago, the Violence Against Women Act has enjoyed broad bipartisan support. It pays for all sorts of programs for victims and prevention, training for local safety officers, and mechanisms to track crime. And with a name like the Violence Against Women Act, it's politically hard to oppose. In fact, it's passed twice by unanimous consent. But this year's reauthorization came amid partisan rancor. The Democrats charged a so-called Republican war on women, and the GOP fired right back, saying the Democrats loaded the bill with provisions to rally their base.
I kind of went against the perspective that my party had taken on this. They had advanced an alternate measure that I didn't think was acceptable.
Senator Lisa Murkowski voted with 14 other Republicans and every Democrat in supporting the final bill. The alternative was introduced by Texas Republican Kay Bailey Hutchison. Her plan removed a provision that would allow tribal courts to prosecute some non-natives for crimes committed in Indian country. But the bill that passed the Senate retained the tribal authority, and it passed with an amendment from Senators Murkowski and Mark Begich, assuring that tribal courts would still be able to issue restraining orders against offenders. That was in doubt early on. Jacqueline Johnson-Peta is the executive director of the National Congress of American Indians.
Bottom line for Indian country is we know that we absolutely must have some kind of jurisdiction over non-Native perpetrators in our communities.
Johnson-Peta, who is Tlingit, says the Senate version of the bill is a step in the right direction. But the practical effect on Alaska's tribal courts is small. Because Metlakatla is the only reservation in the state, it is the only tribal court that will be able to prosecute non-Natives for domestic violence committed on their land. The House version does not have the tribal prosecution language, so Alaska Attorney General Mike Garrity says the state supports the Senate plan. The state does not believe tribes own land as a result of the 1971 Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act.
It's not Native land. It doesn't belong to the tribes. It may belong to a village corporation, it may belong to a Native corporation or a regional corporation. There's other possibilities, but that's the point. The tribes don't own the land.
Speaker of the House John Boehner has appointed 8 members to serve on the panel that will hash out the differences between the two bills. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has not done so yet. When that happens, Julie Kitka hopes the conference committee will heed her advice. She's the president of the Alaska Federation of Natives and wants the final bill to allow the federal government to directly pay the regional tribal groups that manage the Village Public Safety Officer program. Right now, the federal government gives money to the state, which oversees the VPSO program. The state would retain authority over the program, but the money would go straight to the tribes. Kitka says the state does not cover all of the costs of the VPSO program, leaving tribes on the hook.
If you're contracting the state and standing in their place on that you ought to be, you know, your costs ought to be fully covered, just like the Indian Health Service or the BIA contracting or whatever.
The Alaska Federation of Natives is urging Representative Don Young to push for the provision. He said he lobbied for a spot on the conference committee, but ultimately he was not picked.
I don't want any less than what the Senate has, and if we can improve on the what the Senate has done, I'll try to attempt to do so.
Young says he expects Congress to take up the measure when it returns in September. And if history is a guide, Congress should reauthorize it. But there are major sticking points in the two bills. The Senate extends protections to gays and lesbians, and the House does not. With an election mere months off, members of Congress will jump at the chance to make political points over just who deserves legal protection. And while that may help on the campaign, it does not help move the bill through Congress. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The Native Village Corporation, Klukwan Incorporated in Southeast Alaska, filed for bankruptcy this week from member station KHNS. Margaret Friedenauer has the story.
The corporation filed a voluntary petition for Chapter 11, which allows for reorganization, meaning the debtor usually proposes a plan to keep its business alive and pay creditors over time, or the court will determine how the debts will be settled. Klukwan Inc. manager Ralph Strong said the filing stems from an approximately $7 million debt with Travelers Insurance Company. Strong said Travelers was a bonding company for South Coast Construction in Ketchikan, a company owned by the corporation that closed in 2002. Strong said the two companies were never able to come to an agreement on how to settle the outstanding debt. But the main point of concern for Klukwan is that Travelers is trying to put a lien on the distribution it receives from its regional native corporation, Sea Alaska. That, according to Strong, is not allowed under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. So Klukwan filed Chapter 11 to protect itself, he said. Strong said the federal bankruptcy court will make a determination whether such a lien is allowable for collection against a Native corporation. He said that decision will be important for every Native corporation in the state that was formed under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement. In Haines, this is Margaret Friedenauer.
Alaska firefighters are helping battle blazes in the lower 48 again. Alaska Fire Service spokesman Mel Slater says a total of 200 firefighters headed south this week. The deployment includes village and regional crews managed by the state, the Bureau of Land Management, and the U.S. Forest Service. Slater says Alaska is in a position to help out.
The fire season here has slowed, and there are increasing fires down in the lower 48. We're able to send more resources down there to help that effort.
Slater says five Alaska-based firefighting aircraft, a mix of helicopters and planes, remain in the lower 48 since being sent out of state last month. This year's fire season has been slow in Alaska, with only 207,000 acres burned. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a day in the life of Salmon Camp in Bristol Bay.
I really like spending time outdoors and learning about the fish and actually getting to catch them.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable donations. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The Ketchikan-Wrangell House District has the only party primary in Southeast Alaska this year, but candidates in two other districts are still raising money and gearing up campaigns, Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Boundary changes mean most legislative candidates are campaigning in different districts this year. It's affecting the amount of money incumbents and hopefuls need to raise.
You know, the district's getting bigger. We pick up Haines and Metlakatla and Hyder and other areas in between, so it's going to take a little more time to move around.
That's Sitka Republican Senator Bert Stedman. His district used to include his hometown, Petersburg, Ketchikan, and Wrangell. It's lost Petersburg and gained a number of smaller communities, including Angoon, Hoonah, and Cake. His general election opponent, Angoon Democratic Senator Albert Kukesh, has represented the smaller towns for years. Sitka, Ketchikan, and Wrangell have been added to his district, but 100 or so interior communities have been dropped. Kukesh says that means fewer flights.
I used to have to go from Angoon to Juneau, then to Anchorage, then to Fairbanks, and then catch little commuter planes to all those other villages. They didn't have common carriers up there either. You had to take a different carrier almost every village, so there's got to be a lot less traveling.
Travel costs money, and so does introducing yourself to new communities. Kukesh leads in the fundraising race at this point in the campaign. State reports show he's brought in close to $27,000, including funds left over from last year. Stedman has about 20% less, but both say they have much more to raise. Kukesh says he expects to bring in more than $50,000, about double what he's collected so far.
The only thing I've done is fundraisers. I haven't done any online or any of that kind of stuff at all.
Are you getting most of your money from within the district?
Yeah, it was in the district and from just mostly people I know.
He's also held one event in Anchorage. Stedman says he expects his campaign to cost $50,000 to $80,000, but he really hasn't gotten started.
Well, I've got to wait till the boys are done fishing and tourism slows down and we'll have some fundraisers in the communities. But right now, everybody's busy working. Most of the fundraising activity has been going on so far up in Anchorage.
And have you done any of that?
Not this summer, no. And probably not planning on doing any this winter.
The other expensive Southeast race is for the House seat representing Sitka and most of the small communities in the Stedman-Kukesh district. Haines Republican Representative Bill Thomas has brought in close to $60,000, including funds left over from last year. Sitka Democrat Jonathan Christ Tompkins has brought in a quarter of that amount. Like the Kukesh-Stedman race, the candidates face no primary opposition. They'll be up against each other in the November 6th general election. Redistricting has put 59 of Alaska's 60 legislative seats on the ballot. That's about a third more than usual. Kukesh says that spread out campaign donations.
With all of the candidates running this year, except for Dennis Egan, it's really hard to get any money. People are having trouble raising money. And I am too.
Egan, a Democratic senator, is in the middle of his second term representing Juneau. Petersburg and Gustavus were added, but officials decided the district was so similar he could complete the four-year term without an election. Juneau's two representatives, Democrat Beth Kurtula and Republican Kathy Munoz, face no opposition in the primary or general elections. But they've still raised money. Munoz has close to $22,000, Kurtula less than half of that. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
The Fairbanks Catholic Diocese is marking its 50th anniversary this weekend. Events including a Sunday Mass will recognize the roles, good and bad, the church has played in communities across a large area of the state. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The Pope established the Fairbanks Diocese on August 8, 1962, in response to growth of the Catholic Church in interior and western Alaska. Bishop Donald Kettler says the diocese is unique.
Our diocese is about the size of 1.5 Texases, 410,000 square miles, about 50 parishes, 35 of which are without roads, so you only can get there by airplane or by boat or snow machine in the wintertime.
The Fairbanks Diocese includes dozens of Alaska Native communities where Bishop Kettler says traditional spirituality melds well with Catholicism.
Their great love and relationship with nature, the world around them.
Chisham Yua, that means the person of the universe, or the other word that they used was eye of the universe, so that sense of something bigger than themselves.
Sister Josephine Alawelwa grew up in the western Alaska village of Chivak, where she says Chupik beliefs naturally transferred to Catholicism.
They call it Chisangchak, that means you have to be awake, be conscious all the time.
The Catholic Church has not done a very good job of incorporating Native beliefs, but Bishop Kettler says it's working to change that.
Encourage the people to believe that their spirituality was not something bad over in the past, but is something very, very educational for the church as well.
A 50th anniversary mass on Sunday will include reading, songs, and drumming representing several Alaska Native cultures. The mass will also recognize the devastation of sexual abuse of children by Catholic clergy. Hundreds of abuse claims dating back decades in Native villages resulted in a legal settlement in 2009 and subsequent healing efforts by the church and communities. Bishop Kettler says the process has to go beyond apology.
First of all, we have to commit ourselves to saying that we're not going to forget what has happened, because we would never want this to happen again. And then secondly, we're going to do everything we can to protect our young people in the future.
Kettler says policies have been implemented to better screen and oversee clergy. This weekend's 50th anniversary events are expected to draw church officials and parishioners from across the state and nation. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Two bears continue to be a problem along a popular Fairbanks area hiking trail. One of the young grizzly siblings stalked a group of three hikers and their dog on the Granite Tours Trail in the Chena River State Recreation Area last month. The group was able to fend off the animal, but backpacks containing food were left behind. State Parks Northern Region Superintendent Brooks Ludwig says there have been two additional incidents involving the bears since.
Last week when our trail crew was up there, they ran into a couple hikers. One was a gentleman. When they saw him, he still had his pistol out, and these bears came up to him, and he fired a round in front of them. They didn't back off too much, and he fired a few more rounds and hiked out. And then the other one was a gal that was actually staying up at the trail shelter, said the bears approached her, and it was a close enough contact to concern us.
Ludwig says the bears could be the same ones that approached people in the Granite Tours area last summer. He says the animals may associate humans with food, a dangerous situation, and two rangers are headed out the trail this weekend to look for them.
If the rangers run into them and have the opportunity, we're going to go ahead and take them out because they're just getting a little too aggressive, and so we need to deal with that.
The Granite Tours Trail remains open but is posted with bear warning signs.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Aptech is recruiting rural Alaskans for computer and network training with no cost tuition for qualified applicants. For more about the Village Internet Agent Program, call 1-800-478-5389. This message sponsored by Aptech, Alaska's Institute of Technology. For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Ann Hillman. This week on AK, summer camp. Kids can learn to be an astronaut at space camp. For song and dance, maybe it's off to Broadway camp. Fish science? For that, there's no better place than Bristol Bay Salmon Camp. 9 high schoolers from around Alaska learned aquatic science skills as they studied the ecosystem of spawning salmon at Wood-Tikchik State Park recently. KDLG's Dave Benninger joined the budding young scientists and has this story.
High school-age campers from around Alaska are knee-deep in Hanson's Creek, standing among hundreds of bright red sockeye.
You ever seen anything like this before?
No, it looks like there's blood in the water, so many of them.
Tammy, Lorene, and Larissa are measuring the length and recording the gender of the salmon, at least the ones they can get a hold of.
Down, and then someone says
measure it, and like it's 58,
and then we say what their gender, and then we throw them off, but we keep the new one.
Nine high schoolers are wrapping up their week at Salmon Camp on Lake Alegnagik, the first of a series of lakes in Wood-Tikchik State Park, which is an important spawning ground for Bristol-based sockeye. Okay.
So with that, we can make some nice measurements.
Dr. Todd Radenbaugh has been leading the high schoolers through all types of field studies on this ecosystem.
So with that, I guess we're going to do what these guys are doing. Load up!
When they finish their work in the spawning grounds of Hanson's Creek, the group rafts their boats together in the middle of the lake.
You're in a very, very interesting spot that I'd like to talk a little bit about how this landscape evolved. Because it is an evolution, in a sense, of a landscape that allows the salmon to be here.
The students sample the water mid-lake to test against samples taken in the creek.
Okay, we got a pressure sensor and a temperature auger. So, okay, so what does that say? 17 is the temperature, and the depth is 0.1.
Salmon Camp is an opportunity for kids from around the state to explore Bristol-based salmon ecosystem through some hands-on aquatic science. The students can earn a UAF college credit for participating. It's housed out of Camp Polaris on the shore of the lake and at the base of the aptly named Jackknife Mountain. There's no traditional electricity at camp, so the campers' first task each evening is to check on their array of renewable energy sources.
Should be powering.
What kind of equipment we got here?
We got a clamp meter, lets us see how much power is going through a wire. We got the inverter, it changes DC to AC so we can use it. We got a multimeter, we use it as a voltmeter to check the charge of the battery. We got a charge controller so we can leave the panels in the generator out there in the sun and wind and it won't make our batteries boil or explode. We got a couple of fuses, we got a couple kilowatt meters, and a pencil.
What's a pencil for?
Decoration. It's a decorative piece.
The wind turbine has been working in fits and starts.
There we go. Well, it was working.
And it's raining, so the solar panels aren't kicking in much either. One noble volunteer climbs on a bike-powered generator to charge the batteries.
So I can go now?
He's biking, and we're trying to get power out of it.
There it is.
The students opt to nix the camp lights so they have more power for their laptops and at least one iPod. It is summer camp. Then they get to work compiling the day's data. Radenbaugh knows that working with the data isn't as interesting as the field work in the streams, but he says it's how kids pull the big pictures together.
Science in action, yeah. Right now we've got all the students in there trying to put together all this esoterical stuff that they were collecting. Does it really make sense? Well, it starts coming together when you start putting the data together and discussing each other's data to where they start seeing light bulbs go off.
As they put data into PowerPoints they'll be presenting at the end of the week, Cole and Emily take a minute to talk about this camp experience.
We've learned so much here. It's been awesome. It's like hands-on experience. It's not sitting in the classroom getting taught about it.
I really like spending time outdoors and learning about the fish and actually getting to catch them and actually record actual like scientific data.
On their last morning, they dissect char side by side with salmon to compare digestive systems.
We'll look and see what's in there. We'll weigh it. We'll pull out the heart, weigh that, and that'll be it unless you guys want to poke around and look for brains.
But camp isn't over with poking around those brains. The students take their data back to Dillingham and present at a symposium at the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation.
But shifting our world's focus to sustainable energy and resources, I think would really benefit us in the long run.
From standing in streams and chest waders to standing in front of an audience with a PowerPoint, these students' first college credit was well earned. Jason Sear contributed to this story. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're headed to the community of Butte, located at the foot of Bodenberg Butte in the Matanuska-Susitna Valley. It's home to about 3,000 residents.
My name is Britt Lively, and I have lived in Butte for quite some time. We have raised our children here, and the beauty of the area is just unsurpassed. Butte is in the Kinnick River Valley, and The Kinnick River, you know, flows from the Kinnick Glacier and the surrounding glaciers and the mountains. In the 1930s, Butte was part of the Colony Project, and quite a few, the best farming areas were farmed, and there are still farms out there from those days. One of them is the Reindeer Farm. Besides the farm in the actual vegetable industries, there's also one of the largest commercial farms here that grows potatoes mainly for both the Alaska and also for the Chinese market. They've developed Chinese seed potatoes that are highly priced, and they export them to China. And we also have quite a large horse industry. Many people have horses, and of course they all spend money to go to the hay farmers. And the recreation, you know, at our back door extends from Mud Lake and all the way up to the glacier. It's a very heavily used area since the Kinnick River Public Use Area was created. And at this point, people are trying to find balance in recreation so that both motorized and non-motorized people will be able to enjoy everything. Way back when, a very young family, we were looking for a house in Anchorage and couldn't get financing for it. So we saw this ad. There's 10 acres on a creek with a log house on it for $15,000. The realtor even at the time advised us not to get it.
Britt Lively is a longtime resident of Butte. She lives there with her domestic partner, 5 horses, and a mule. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Dave Benninger, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week when we head to the depths of the permafrost tunnel near Fairbanks. I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth, and organizations often become stronger as a result. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers competitive interest rates with programs tailored for first-time homebuyers and home choice seminars that cover the details of purchasing and financing a home. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.